So, the Institute for Advanced Technology in Government is this mysterious new organization that hasn't been heard much from or about. I think readers of magazines like Government Computer News may have seen some notices about it, and about the fact that Jim Simon, who was the assistant director of the CIA, is the founder of it, and some other folks, including yourself and Aris Pappas, who formerly worked in various kinds of government roles, you at the DIA, are there. What is it? What's going on there? What's this about?
What is this? Well, I would probably say a better word than mysterious would be quiet,
Quiet.
and quiet not as a function of pure intent, but partly because we're new and small. So the Institute was set up by Bill Gates and Craig Mundie in 2004, actually 4 years ago this week. So we're celebrating our quadrennial anniversary here. It's like a whenever the Olympics roll around, something interesting happens around the world. And 4 years ago, Gates and Mundie decided that an interesting aspect for Microsoft's corporate and strategic value to the community of technologists writ large would be to play a more strategic role in the eyes of government. And actually, in our title, and you said it correctly, except there's a very final letter on the end of that long name. So it's the
S.
Institute for Advanced Technology in Governments, plural,
Yeah.
which sounds a little odd, except that we're not solely focusing on the U.S. federal government, which I think the background of the most of the people involved would imply, and I can expand on that. But it's actually governments at all levels, and we've worked a little bit with state and local governments here in the U.S., and we have increased our headcount in the last year to seven people total. Wow, seven people. But the seventh was actually an interesting addition himself, Bob Hayes. He's actually a British citizen, lives and works in Cambridge, UK. He actually, his office is at the Microsoft Research Lab in Cambridge. And he came out of experience at all levels of UK government. Began as a beat cop, a bobby, and has worked in and around particularly security and national security community in the UK for his entire career. So that's our first minor toe in the water of looking internationally, which is something that Craig Mundie does a lot. In any case, for his real day job as the chief research and strategic officer.
So you guys appear to have close ties to Microsoft Research, but are not formally a research unit, or do you consider yourselves to be one? What's the story
No,
there?
not formally. We do work very closely with them, and anticipate working closely with them and other product groups. We're actually so our The leader of our little workers collective is Jim Simon, the first one hired. And Jim reports directly to Craig. So we're basically overhead under Craig. And it's a great position because we're able to see, have visibility into the entirety of the kinds of strategic and future-oriented work that Microsoft is doing, not just strictly MSR. But also incubation and what live labs and office labs and a lot of other forward-thinking people in different product groups are doing. We've established some interesting relationships. A lot of it is personal. We are, it's just seven people, as I mentioned. I joined just 7 months ago. It's been a wonderful way to see inside this tiny little 90,000 employee company.
I thought it was like 70, but maybe we've gained 20 in the last 2 weeks. Who knows?
I think it's gone up. You're going to have to check, John. I believe we've just crested 90,000.
So, I guess in some sense, governments are a specialized kind of enterprise, and so there are all sorts of potential applications for Microsoft's enterprise-oriented technologies that might be specific to government applications, and that may be part of it. You should tell me. I mean, what are the kinds of
that
things
is
you're
a big part of it?
Is it
you've hit on exactly the core mission, which is to assist particularly U.S. governments, so our federal government, different state governments, and eventually we hope local governments and NGOs to focus on their enterprise-wide problems, of which there are many. They are not only as bureaucratic organizations, they're not only a lot like commercial enterprises, corporate organizations, but they have particular unique challenges which you probably don't really understand unless you've had the pleasure and the frustration of working inside a large, particularly bureaucratic federal government organization, as most of us in this group did.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have, and my colleagues all served at fairly senior levels of large bureaucratic organizations, you really understand the pain, particularly within, not alone, but particularly within our national security community. So the intelligence community and the Department of Defense, massive bureaucratic constellations of organizations. So DOD is not just one single department. It's a conglomeration of enormous and very different kinds of groups, as is the intelligence community with its 16 different agencies. So I think five out of the seven in our group have at least some background in that national security community. I didn't have a career in it, but I spent the last 4 years, as you mentioned, at the Defense Intelligence Agency. I came from different kind of public sector and then Silicon Valley background after 9/11 to try and bring a little new thinking to the intelligence community, and I and a lot of other people, we were able to do some of that, and it was interesting along the way that as I looked out at the different strategic partners that government has in the technology world, we certainly viewed Microsoft as important just because we, like most others, were on a Windows and an Office platform.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of other Microsoft products that we used. But it, to be honest, it was really limited to that. We thought of Microsoft as a product vendor. And one thing that began to change my mind was as a government executive, I used to come back annually for visits to the Microsoft EBC in Redmond, and the account team that supported our agency began to hear from me that, you know, we noticed that Microsoft was spending $6 and $7 billion a year in R&D, and I wondered, you know, where's that money going, and how much of it is focused on assisting government problems, and the answer was at least consciously, the answer in the minds of MSR was none of it. And not by any act of commission, just that's not where they thought of early adopters really residing. And yet here I was in the intelligence community and worked a lot with DOD as we were fighting this long war on terror, and being surrounded by the most keen of early adopters in the world. People who were working with many other Silicon Valley companies and large enterprise tech firms to really stretch the limits of what research could do with technology. And I began to talk with Microsoft about that and discovered that they had indeed set up this quiet group in 2004, and that it was interested in doing more along the lines of consulting with government in quiet ways, both inside that community and elsewhere, on these kinds of major enterprise problems, and bringing to bear some of the more interesting, more promising fruits of Microsoft research. So
there are a whole bunch of Microsoft technology initiatives that are on the table that obviously intersect with the interests of governments as large enterprises, as IT-supported enterprises. So we could point to identity management. We could point to a set of data management technologies. We could point to a set of systems management technologies. We could point to, service-oriented architecture stuff. We could point to, various kinds of application development. All of that stuff, though, I suspect that's already in the pipeline, in terms of how it's going to play out in governments like it's playing out in other enterprises. And so that's maybe not what you mean by advanced technologies in governments?
Correct.
Okay, yeah.
Although many of those are very much of interest, and frankly, the government, let's just use big G governments, so federal government and big state governments, they're really often not aware, and because of their acquisition cycles, they're incredibly disincentivized from being aware of what the leading edge, not to say cutting edge, but what's the leading edge in commercial software and technology,
right,
and practices. So one side function that we do is a kind of advisory role to make them aware of those best practices and the leading edge things in a way that doesn't come across as just a sales pitch, because they don't need to hear that. And frankly, if we have ways of advising government leaders that they can innovate that don't necessarily involve Microsoft products, then that's a plus for Microsoft, as for the Institute and for Microsoft's role in assisting government as well. And we've done that several times.
Yeah.
Our sales guys understandably focus on, here's what I can sell to you today and in the next quarter, and that's a great function, but often what government needs to hear is, well, how can I do something better either with what I have or something that's not Microsoft? So we do a little bit of that, and many of those things that you just ticked off fit that role. But I'll give you a case study of something that's a little different, and I believe it's a beginning to be a success for our institute and for others inside Microsoft. That's more along the lines of what we try to focus on.
Okay.
And that's Surface. So Surface now has gotten a lot of buzz and a lot of interest, and now is being commercially rolled out, as you know, with AT&T and other partners in the entertainment space. When Surface was still a research project, Jim Simon, partly because he just likes goofing around with odd nooks and crannies of MSR and incubation projects, saw it and talked with the team that was early on working on Surface, and discovered that they were mostly focused on it as a gaming platform.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat and thought about that for a while and said to them, there are two additional markets where you might get some traction with this, and he knew people in each. One would be in the, not the kind of small G gaming world, but the big G gaming world of casinos. And the kind of large-scale entertainment venue-based gaming industry that's in Vegas and Atlantic City, and where the entertainment experience that's offered to visitors is one that involves a kind of holistic view of the individual customer from the second that they show up at their hotel, day and night, on the casino floor and the shows, and the different kinds of off-site and restaurant things that they do over the course of their time there. And if you look now at, I'm not saying anything new now, because the marketing of Surface is achieving great traction in that world, because the nature of the touch and the back-end architecture of what the touchscreen or the touch-enabled middleware and the UI, what it's able to bring together really supports that kind of scenario. So that was one thing. And then the other one that he knew really well was the national security world, particularly
sure.
DOD. And it so happened that when I came on board last year and first learned about Surface, I said, well, you may not know this, but when I was at the Defense Intelligence Agency, we were among the very first customers of touch tables, a different kind of technology, an actual touch screen on a pool table-sized device that was sold to us by one of the large defense contractors. And they were doing a great job for us in 2004 and 2005 with this large device. The price point for it, though, was $250,000 a piece per device.
And what were you able to do with it?
Well, if you think about defense planners, they very typically do their job standing around a big sheet of paper or a large map and trying to work collaboratively
mm-hmm.
With, you know, 2 or 10 people standing around that map and trying to plan out a day's or a month's or a year's campaign. Doing that the old way, either on a whiteboard or on a wall-mounted map or on a map on a table or on a sandbox, another traditional way of doing it. There really haven't been any innovations in how you do that. And so planning mm-hmm. in Pentagon circles is still traditionally done that way.
Mm-hmm.
With a touch table device, as we first bought in 2004, you're actually able to show on this horizontal surface a map and data layers on that map.
Yep.
So if you think about Virtual Earth or Google Earth and what they're able to do on a PC screen, the ability to do that on a large 6x9 table actually becomes appealing, particularly if it can be collaborative and you have people standing around the table and able to switch the orientation of the view and to call up different data.
Sure, sure. Now, was this commercial software and a custom device, or was it all custom?
It was all custom.
Okay.
All custom. The device itself and the embedded software, $250,000 a pop.
Okay.
We bought two of them when I was working at DIA. We had one on one floor of our building, one on another floor, two different teams working on them. And after a little while, we said, geez, it'd be nice if these things could collaborate. The people on one could see what the team on the other is looking at a particular moment, and they could collaborate. And because of the custom software, it wasn't there was no real IP connection. They weren't networked together.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to pay the our contractor another $100,000 just to do the networking of them back and forth. And it kind of worked. But when I first saw Microsoft Surface and realized that the entire thing ran on a regular essentially run-of-the-mill, just state-of-the-art PC,
yep.
And that the set of APIs that were already being planned were going to be open enough for developers and partners to put any kind of Windows software on there, and that it would all be networked. That was part of the initial design anyway for an online gaming scenario.
Mm-hmm.
It really opened up the possibilities, and then when you realized that because of the scale that Microsoft traditionally works at, that the price point was going to be not $250,000 per unit, but just $10,000.
Yep.
It just blew my mind. So now working with that same defense contractor, we've very early on, I think they were among the very first partners to begin developing on the Surface platform because they see their value as custom, customer-centric kinds of development on a Surface platform. They can do that really well. They know their customer. They know the scenarios that defense and intelligence planners want to use, homeland security, state police and local police. There's a lot of interest in that kind of platform. And I think the Institute played a a small but helpful role in opening the eyes of a lot of people to what the kind of difference that a Microsoft platform could bring to that.
That's a great example. So from your vantage point, seeing what kinds of needs like that exist within the world that you came from and being able to connect those to activities that are occurring at Microsoft, maybe at Microsoft Research, what are some of the other connections that you hope to be able to make?
Well, I'll tell you just a couple. I have been extremely interested in robotics and in the emerging large-scale appeal of the robotics studio.
Yes.
Microsoft Robotics Studio.
Yes.
And you and I have chatted about this a little bit. The appeal there is not so much, as you know, in the fact that that this is actually currently released as a robotics platform. The appeal is in the back-end architecture that takes advantage of parallel processing and advances in concurrency and high-performance computing and in distributed services.
Yes.
And so as you mentioned, SOA, and SOA has been a kind of buzzword in government circles and other kinds of enterprise circles for a while now. Well, there really are multiple services being developed and deployed in lots of different environments, and government no different. The ability to actually orchestrate enormous numbers of those services is something that can really be exploited to take advantage of computational power now. And that's something that you can do natively with the robotics studio, whether or not you actually have as your intent designing and developing a robot, per se.
No, it's a fascinating outgrowth of that project, and I think it's only beginning to sink in because, as you say, it has been largely pigeonholed in the category of robotics, but the software infrastructure is extraordinarily general purpose.
That's right. And, so when we look at government early adopters, the people that that we've seen take a good deal of interest in this have been in DARPA, who we've talked with quite a bit about this, and there's a new organization just set up within the last year in the intelligence community. It's an analog of DARPA called IARPA, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency. And so IARPA is also very interested, not just in the robotics side, but particularly in the complexity of computational utility that you can get out of very complex designs using that platform. It's really a fascinating thing once you get the right people looking at this, and they, as you just said, they understand what's really behind it and the power of it.
So you've also been someone who's been known for an interest in what we could call Web 2.0 methods, and are someone who's responsible for bringing IntelliPedia to life, as I understand it. And
one of it was a great team.
Yeah. And you've been writing about government 2.0 a little bit on your blog recently. What do you see as some opportunities in that space?
Well, that is a fascinating field for government. So I've been watching with great interest the rise of the notion of Enterprise 2.0. And I think most people give credit to Andrew McAfee up at Harvard Business School for coining that. And
yeah.
He and I have spoken a number of times together on panels or actually working on how government organizations can nurture bottom-up development of advanced capabilities using things like wikis and blogs and social software and take advantage of the emerging power of social media. Without the kinds of constraints that you inevitably get within a government bureaucracy. So not only do they have all the usual bureaucratic problems of large commercial organizations, but they also have a kind of hypersensitivity to security And there's also, kind of particularly in large federal bureaucracies, there's within the civil service, there's a kind of it's been written about broadly, the kind of disincentivizing of innovation, because people are career civil servants and there's not necessarily the same reward structure for innovation in career paths of federal employees, including tech employees, the IT staffs of, mm-hmm. of government bureaucracies often don't exhibit the same kind of verve and vigor that you get in the commercial space. So how do you nurture that and crack open the ceiling to grassroots development of these and adoption of these kinds of technologies? And one of the things really is it's a very personal thing. You have to find the right people within an enterprise. I was lucky to have an inside role in the intelligence community, and when you say Intellipedia, which people may or may not know about, Intellipedia is a phenomenal success story in the intelligence community for it as a community. That phrase was openly mocked for a couple of decades because the 16 different agencies, and particularly the big ones that everybody knows about, the CIA, NSA, DIA, NRO, NGA, the alphabet soup of them all, they really didn't collaborate that well at all, if at all.
Yep.
And 9/11 and the WMD commission, those two commissions both went into great detail about this. One of the things that I and others were able to do was to begin work in small ways on identifiable chunks of value that we could create for community-wide use on shared networks. And this work all began essentially 2004. And a wiki, looking at Wikipedia, I don't think there was any great flash of inspiration in deciding to basically plagiarize Wikipedia on a secure network as a large-scale wiki to contain socially authored and socially maintained intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that information that people were typically keeping in stovepipe databases, to actually free that within on a wiki platform, which we did starting the first pilot of it was in late 2004, and it opened as an enterprise system for the entire intelligence community in 2006. Intellipedia has been a big success, and it had an early period of hockey stick growth that's leveled off a little bit now, and I think the challenge, like any other enterprise, is to continue evangelizing the business practices of social networking and the value that they bring within a large, diverse set of organizations.
Yeah, no, the point to make here is that there was definitely not any kind of advanced technology that went into that success story, right? It was an instance of MediaWiki, and there were blogs going on, but these things are just sort of garden variety. You know, these are like the kudzu, tools of the internet now, right? So, I mean, it was really, I would say as an outside observer, it was more an exercise in social engineering than it was an exercise in the deployment of any particular new or advanced technology. And that was completely appropriate. But so that being the case, from a Microsoft perspective, what do you think can and should happen? You know, is it a case of is it about advanced technologies coming out of Microsoft Research that can add to this equation, or is it about bringing some of that sensibility into the Microsoft platform, coming from the grassroots perspective? What do you think?
Well, I think it's both of those. One is the world I know the best right now, anyways, the federal government space. But I know we have analogous activities going on at the state and local. But in the federal space, and particularly for the intelligence community, because these are knowledge workers on steroids, we have an interesting mindset within the account teams who are working on this, where they themselves are not only focusing on, okay, here's what can be done with SharePoint 2007, here's what can be done in Office 2007 with its great XML background, but they're actually eagerly seeking out little bits of code that's being worked on in places like Live Labs, like Office Labs, PopFly.
Mm-hmm.
So PopFly is being heartily evangelized by Microsoft teams within the federal government, and it's getting enormous receptivity.
I have heard of this from John Montgomery, who is an old friend of mine and is the PopFly lead. And yeah, so say a little bit more about...
Too much so. We saw John last week with some government visitors that we brought back to Redmond, and he's to the point of almost being overwhelmed. I mean, the PopFly team is not the world's largest. And
right.
What I see in a small way, and you don't have to beat people over the head of this, is a changing mindset about Microsoft and the role it can play in providing value to government. It's not just about are we on a Windows platform? It's what can I use technologically on my computer, on my mobile device, that's going to enable me to do things that I wasn't able to do before.
Mm-hmm.
And if those are Microsoft things that have a Windows label in front of them, that's great. If they're things like John Montgomery's PopFly, which look cool and funky and very web-centric, then that's great too. So
tell me if this fits into the charter for your group. One of the aspects, at least, of how I regard Government 2.0 is this growing movement in sort of the transparent availability of various sources of government data. There is, at this point, a growing consensus that data will be made available, and data is being made available. But it's typically being made available in a mode that reminds me of what was happening on the scientific web until fairly recently, and mostly still is, which is that, yeah, there's the data. It's a, you know, gazipped tarball. Go get it. Have fun. Right?
Right.
As opposed to, you know, here is a service layer that's been interposed between the raw data and both applications and human beings who are going to be the consumers and analysts of that data. And at least to me, it seems like there's an interesting possible role here for Microsoft, and I see it as an extension of something that's happening in the relationship between MSR and the scientific community. So I've recently been talking to a lot of people in Tony Hayes' area and have been talking to people who are MSR, I would call them informaticians, who are working closely with scientists. In every branch of science now, a deluge of data, and kind of the definition of science is evolving into one where experiments are conducted and analysis is done in the context of previously unimaginable quantities of data. And one of the things I'm seeing Microsoft kind of consistently doing in these partnerships with scientists is to provide some infrastructure and also some, I guess you could say, consulting expertise in terms of how to wrap your arms around large bodies of data and make them useful in ways that they wouldn't otherwise be. And I just am wondering if there's not scope for something analogous to that to happen as increasingly these sources of government data are made available to citizens, but not necessarily, at least in the first generation, in ways that enable citizens to, you know, sort of ask and answer meaningful questions or relate the raw information to policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've hit on something that's not only really important, which I think is why you're hitting on it, it's also... it's an interest of ours. It's very hard to do, but if you do it, the value is tremendous, obviously. So I'll give you a couple examples of things that we're thinking about and one that we're working on with our institute. One that we're thinking about is as a model is something that one member of our group that I want to mention is named George Spix, because he's such a great guy. A lot of people around Microsoft know George.
I know. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's the only guy in our group who's been with Microsoft for quite a while. He's been here, I think, almost 20 years. And he had his background with Cray, Seymour Cray, on Cray Computing, Supercomputing.
Actually, I have to tell you one little thing about George you might not have heard.
Sure.
But there was a conference that was hosted at the Microsoft Conference Center a couple of weeks ago about the Space Elevator Project.
Yeah.
And George was the guy that gave the go-ahead for that to occur.
Yeah. Well, I can believe it, because that's the... very closely related to the example I was going to mention, which is Worldwide Telescope.
Uh-huh.
So George also did a little bit of work on that. And if you think about it, that exemplifies what you were talking about.
Absolutely. The Worldwide Telescope is the paradigmatic example of a service layer, which has been interposed between a previously available but practically inaccessible data set and not only a series of interoperable applications, but basically ordinary folks on the other end of it, right? You're right. I mean, it's the perfect prototype for that.
It is. And so as such, it also serves as the perfect educational device for people who are in a position of authority over other large stovepiped unavailable data sets.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we've been doing is using Worldwide Telescope as a teaching element of here's the future of what your world could be. And it's not only an extremely appealing app. I mean, it's just, people fall in love with it. Robert Scopel was moved to tears by it, famously. But it's also, as you said, the kind of paradigmatic simplicity and obviousness of the appeal of it. And the utility of opening up access to data. So we've been using that in a number of ways to educate and stretch the kind of mental boundaries that government officials have about the data that they have, the accessibility that they currently offer, and new technologies and web scale computing could bring to their data and what that would do for them and their intent to serve their customers or their users or their citizens. And it really is kind of a mind-blowing way to get them thinking creatively about what could be done. So we're working on several projects along those lines. And similarly with more directly using machine translation and some of the hybrid translation approaches that Microsoft Research is pushing the boundaries on. Because, yet again, there's an example where we have live examples already offered within the Windows Live constellation of things that people don't really know about. There's the translator bot that is a live messenger client. You can actually... have simultaneous translation to one of a dozen or more languages in your instant messaging.
Actually, I hadn't seen that myself.
Well, there you go. And that's live. You can use that as well. The live translator plug-in for Internet Explorer, I just blogged about that last week, that enables surfing foreign language websites and having it simultaneously translated right in the browser as you surf from site to site. It's really changed the way that it's basically opened up the foreign language web to me, so I no longer only surf traditionally English language sites. I have a lot of interest in Russia and Russian, and my schoolboy Russian is pretty rusty now, so being able to surf Russian language or Chinese sites and have a pretty good and definitely a good enough machine translation of the content appear right in the browser as I surf around is just phenomenally opening. And as we show that and its availability as a service, to be exploited within service architectures. That's something that governments are finding really intriguing, and they're beginning to think about how they could architect better access to the data that they have to diverse populations. And again, that's something that they may or may not have thought of Microsoft as being a thought leader on, but they're certainly thinking that now.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because they're in this particular area, I have been pushing for a while, and I've concluded recently that we're in some ways kind of stuck on this question of access to the data. And I think that there's a sense on the part of a lot of people that once that's done, right, once you've got the files sitting out there, then you're all set, you're good to go. And that's, you know, and that's only the first step. And, you know, so, you know, it's great that we're getting to the point where it's expected that that first step will be taken, but there's, you know, so much more that now can be shown and done. And, you know, I would, I just kind of personally, selfishly hope that, I wind up being part of the company that takes a leadership role in that, because there's lots of headroom.
Yeah, well, I'll give you another example right along those lines. And I had that same kind of lingering feeling of frustration about the web and the billions and billions of pages and documents and sites that that I theoretically can access right now, but there's no sense making among them.
Yep.
And so one of the most exciting things that I saw last year, even before joining Microsoft, was PhotoSynth,
mm-hmm.
and combined with Sea Dragon. And so that got a lot of exposure at the TED conference last year. And what's now being done with PhotoSynth and with Sea Dragon and some of the related pieces of technology, Deep Zoom and HD View, we, the Institute, are working on making those available to government organizations that have access to very large, they have enormous data archives of images particularly, which are just sitting there. Yes, theoretically you have electronic access to them in a kind of old world keyword or search and retrieval process, but something like PhotoSynth makes allows you to make sense out of the enormity of collections like that.
What kind of image databases would you be talking about?
Well, some I can talk about and some mm-hmm. are pretty confidential
yeah,
in government,
yeah.
But we have been talking with a few state government organizations about their access to the world of Flickr and online collections like that from the standpoint of Homeland Security and first responders, and the ability to actually make sense of the visual environment of today's world in a moment-to-moment way, just based on the open-source information that's available. It's something that Microsoft has actually helped a lot of public sector groups like the Los Angeles Fire Department and Police Department to be real leaders on.
So it sounds like what you might be saying here is that there's a lot of documentation of planet Earth that is being done in an ad hoc, you know, sort of grassroots way, as represented by, let's say, the pool of photos on Flickr, which might be geolocated in a certain way or tagged in a certain way, and that there might actually be a government interest in making sense out of those collections as more up-to-date, more on-the-ground records of what exists than anything else that's available.
That's right, and it eventually works in a circular way on the provision of government services back to people.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the ability of a government bureaucrat traditionally going with a clipboard of information to a local site,
yep.
In the sense of like a building inspector, and you go and you inspect the site and you may take a photograph or two and you certify that the site is being worked on in a way conforming with local or county regulations, blah, 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 it's meeting zoning criteria. You go back, you file that report. Well, the ability to do all that in real time with a hand handheld device with your, you know, your cell phone with a camera in it,
mm-hmm.
to transmit that in a secure way, and it's geolocated, it's time-stamped. If it's in Windows Mobile 7, it's going to have a cryptographically secured way of transmitting that data that's secure and will stand up in court.
Mm-hmm.
That really opens up the world of what, think about that deployed in child care and child welfare scenarios where there certainly aren't enough government personnel to visit all of the troubled domiciles where they're getting reports, and to do it in a timely fashion, but the ability to actually make sense of large volumes of data transmitting both ways between citizens and their government and back to the citizens. It really opens up the world in new ways. We haven't figured out a lot of these, but it's just fascinating to try and think about the problems of government as a diverse set of enterprise challenges and what kinds of technologies we have in the nooks and crannies of Microsoft that might be able to help.
Well, sounds like you're having fun snooping
I'm
around
having
finding
a blast.
Good. Well, this has been excellent.
Well, thanks.
Take care.
Thanks, John.